Rising river blue, running by my door.
I'm happy to introduce tonight my friend and colleague, Nick Triolo. He is so amazing that I had to write down all the things that he's done that are incredible so I would remember them. Though I was reading The Independent today, and there's an article about you, Nick. There was a mention of your adventures and your activism. So Nick has a long history of activism. I think his most impressive feat was running 70 miles across the mountains. Can you imagine running 70 miles across the mountains in one day?
No.
It's heroic. Originally, he's from Murphy, California, which I'm told is in Northern California.
I see.
Never been to California myself. I'm sure it's lovely. In 2006, he took off and traveled around the entire world, covering, I'm told, 12 countries. Did you run around the world, Nick?
No.
You should have lied. It's a shame. Anyway, he's a photographer in his spare time when he's not being a grad student and writing amazing pieces. The one he's going to read tonight, I'm told, is brand new. None of us who've been in shop with Nick have heard it yet, so I'm really looking forward to it, Nick. All right.
Cool.
Boy Stripe's face deep with color, lathered thick and slanting. He bursts outside through frail screen door, heart thud-a-dumping like battle drum phantoms, scouring hilltop mist moist. How else can I respond but to fight them? Gnashed teeth spitting curses under breath. Bonfires for eyes, boy fists, rosebush battle axe, knuckled crip, bleeding, trembling. Charging up the hill, he screams, he hates, he burns. Infantries of grass part not for this commitment to carnage. But the enemy needs to die. When boy finally reaches the front lines, the edge, all he finds is water. No ghouls, no fire-heaving monsters, no fanged Krampus. Just water. Just placid hydroglass. Just him and pond. War paint coagulant alchemizes with sweat and sorrow, refractive confusion. Chest rising, chest falling like leavened bread. Where are you? Boy's murderous voice fires sonic blanks in search of other. Stripping his clothes, ripping, boy hangs bleached underwear upon caribou antler velvet and wades into pond. The war paint begins cascading, preamble to rainstorm. Drips, drops, drips, drops. Technicolor tier after tier. Warbler yellow, cobalt blue, and fireball red. Breached levees of swollen eyelid. And he collapses. He descends beneath pond, mirroring a young, wiry composite, heaped of bone and fat, muscle and wound. Surrendered implosion. When boy finally resurfaces, he has pond scum for hair, lily pads for ears, cattail spike for a nose, and minnows for lips. The war paint is gone. So boy leaves his old clothes, abandons underwear hanging, scribbling, obey, into wind's outstretched palm. And he walks on all fours with his cattail nose, his scummy hair, his lily ears, and his fishy lips. Back down the hill. Through grass infantries raising their blades high in wild solidarity. Back home, naked, light, free, surrendered, victorious. Thanks. Thanks. That was a most recent attempt at a poem. It's called War Paint. Thanks for listening. Thanks for coming. I have just two poems and then a piece of prose. This next poem I wrote, last winter I lived in Mexico for 4 months, and on my way back, hooked up with a ferry, hitched a ride up to Flagstaff and met a bunch of friends in Flagstaff to have a crazy adventure in the Grand Canyon. And after the Grand Canyon, jutted out to Las Vegas, where we stayed the night in Las Vegas, and where we all flew out to our respective homes. And we woke up and we all realized that it was Earth Day. So we spent Earth Day in the morning of Earth Day in Las Vegas, and it was a really interesting experience. So this is what came out of it. Hotel linen sterility bleached blank swapped. Let's start over. Hotel linen sterility, bleached blank, swapped by invisibles, overworked, hiding in shadows. Flat screen stares long, cold and grinning. Pixelated price tags taut, groggy animal eyes. The boob tube bleeds panic, news anchor makeup dripping from chin, prying, trying, crying. Aircon meat freezer, dull machine biz buzz. Decry, deny, and defy the intensifying warming world outside. Parking lot, feedlot, lonely lines painted conformity cream, factory farm eggs stand no chance on this searing sidewalk. Paper pup cup caffeine honoring tree with a quickie, a harmless rape. Styrofoam saucer eyes, single use everything, disposable all. Shower blasting, sipping playfully from stolen water. Scrub quickly, save the whales. Front desk facade in hot pursuit of the American dream. Banana and tailpipe. Follow corporate crumbs and clever acronyms. WINTAM. ROAR. LOST. S-O-S. Hooters, Bellagio, Circus Circus, psychic porous, poisonous pour-overs, towers of excess, toothless grin, rapacious rotting from the inside out. To the airport, to the great carbon party, gasping trumpet, asphyxiated elephant, monkey contact, scoff. Tuck behind digivale, micro bulb lumens ablaze, snuggle nearest, avatar dearest, perfumes of the posturing, apply liberally. Stay where it's safe, do not engage, color inside the lines, otherwise you'll get hurt, and don't you forget, the house always wins. Thanks. Okay, enough of the poetry. this next piece is a new piece. It's called The Ecology of Escape. It's organized into three short stories. I hope you enjoy it. May it speak to the psychoadolescent escapist in all of us, and certainly in today's consumer cultural response to ecological collapse. The Ecology of Escape. Redwood Whisper. It was all as well after dinner and beyond bedtime when I made my move, they said. Barely 15 months old, I would wait until my mother switched off the lights. Those final flames extinguished with pursed lip and heavy eyelash from the day's accumulations. Demands from both self and system. Work hard, do well, produce, seduce your market, grin, grin, smile, smile for your customers. Selling is a personal thing. Don't you forget that. My parents had decided to start a family and a business at the same time, raising my older brother and me in a thimble-sized loft at the edge of California's Santa Cruz Mountains. My first breaths joined the respiration of surrounding redwood forest, a veritable trust fall, each limb padding my entrance into this world. These giants made a commanding presence in all corners of early life, even the civilized ones. Born in Redwood City, delivered in Sequoia Hospital, and raised in Woodside. Redwood trees hold silent space masterfully, akin somehow to snowflake crystals in winter. John Steinbeck knighted redwoods ambassadors from another time, and I would second that designation. We humans whirl in and out of existence on the wingtips of hummingbirds, while redwoods waltz through epochs in deep temporal stride, some aged over 5,000 years. The patience reflects an unusually frugal water transfer system, flowing right just underneath the bark, in a tissue called the xylem. This layer of small, pipe-shaped cells composes a unique hydrating superhighway, shuttling nutrients slowly through the conifer's wood. After drawing water through lateral roots, sustenance creeps up the redwood spine to their crown, gravitational subversion, sometimes traveling the length of an entire football field, over 300 feet. Leaves at the top release water vapor, then taunt water molecules milling below to come fill the void, to join the party. I imagine the treetop foliage yelling, "You gotta get up here, the view's great. And bring some snacks while you're at it." So the water trusts, the food arrives, and we experience growth. Lots of it. The water trusts this process of change, of renewal. The nutrients trust the ascent all the way to knuckled branches, orchestrating sky-noted melodies above. Draw and release. Draw and release. Draw, release. A particular stand of redwoods monitored my first 2 years of growth. They whispered to each other. The tune oscillated between root and wild, drifting all the way off into the circadian rhythms of my crib. Perhaps that's why I cried incessantly for the first few years. I wanted out, to draw from the depths of soil and send myself upwards to pond freckles for stars. Instead, I was met with a system full of walls, met with no's, no's, and hell no's. These impediments left me confused. Something felt incompatible, inconsistent, incongruent. Primordial expectations remained underwhelmed. So I would escape. I would escape often. Hours after I was put to bed, my parents would find me crawling around our home. There was simply no explanation. My crib walls were way too high for babies to scale, they said. No 15-month-old could get remotely close to sneaking out. Loose slat, hole in the bed. Inspections were made, screws tightened. Nothing worked. After a few more incidents, one evening my grandmother staked out in my bedroom shadows to solve the mystery. She sat in the darkness and waited for hours. Nothing happened. She returned to her bed and came back a second night. Nothing. Whenever she visited, she would try to uncover my getaway tactics without any luck. And finally, weeks later, she witnessed an escape artist at work. Grandmother's eyes must have been burning, the white parts piercing through dark, unable to blink. After my parents left the room and my crying trailed off, I remained motionless, but only until I knew it was clear. Then I struck. My head was the first to pop up. After a quick survey, I pushed my body up and began to move. Pudgy hands gripped the slats and I pulled myself up, diaper sagging. Grandma spilled her tea after I swung a distinct heel hook onto the crib's railing. It's true. Grandma spilled her tea after I swung a distinct heel hook onto the crib's railing, inched my body to the top and straddled the rim, 3 feet off the ground. And when the timing was just right, I leaned off and fell off the crib, catching the railing with my hands. And I hung there, suspended in midair, and contemplated the drop. Then I let go. I plunged to the carpet below, meeting it with a bounce, and all of a sudden I was free. Free to grow in precisely the direction I wished. This had become a ritual of mine for just a moment. For just a moment I thrust forth into some boundless space, like the redwoods, but only to be promptly scooped up and directed back to my crib, back into boxes and pacifiers, pacifying wild growth. Of course, it's impossible to determine the intentions of an infant, but there was something to this liberation, something about new life forms expecting to take their limbs wherever they desired, to explore both soil and sky, untrammeled and free. During these early years, redwood whispers invited me to grow as they grew, slow but with great plans, not forced into a controlled funhouse of mirrored halls and cul-de-sac dead ends. From roots to burl to leaves spinning double helix dervishes atop redwood crown, I still imagine them urging me forward, whispering to seek the same, to choose my own name. Treehouse. God found me in a treehouse one afternoon. A late August glow had just trickled in, marinating the foothills, softened and bronzed, hollow and heavy. Soil cracked around the mighty oak's tree base, broiled from another summer of record blaze. The treehouse was no average structure. Suspended 20 feet off the ground, this arbor fortress boasted two sturdy levels with a connecting staircase and a 100-foot zip line departing from its northeast. I had it all to myself. Well, God and me. For several years, my parents struggled after moving into the Bay Area's suburbs. So when I entered middle school, we relocated east to a small town in the Sierra Nevada mountains. I didn't like this move at first, as a 10-year-old boy wiggling through his preteen topsoil. Having to leave friends and comfortable rhythms was painful, but I got it. I understood it well. They wished to escape. Now, reading the tidal charts of human settlement around San Francisco is simple. It began with thousands of coastal Miwok, Yokut, Costanoan, and Winton natives who were, baffler number one, desecrated in a blink by disease and hegemony paved over by Spanish missionaries. In independent Mexico acquires California, set up shop, but was bought out by the Union in 1850. The sheen and glean and promise you'll leave here rich as hell enticed hordes to pile westward. Bullion on the brain. Wars, productivity, industry, babies, more war, more productivity, more industry, and more babies. San Francisco and its opportunist towns nearby bubbled over with urban life. Arts, culture, and industry followed, while also, baffler number two, wretched levels of poverty, crime, prostitution, and anxiety. So with this urban vacuum came a strong undercurrent of rural escape, that animal urge for space and abundance and quiet. I learned later that my family's move was actually a last-ditch effort to salvage a wilting marriage. As tension rose in our new house with greater frequency, I would slip out the back window and disappear into Manzanita and Ponderosa spread for miles. This ungovernable tangle outside caught me at just the right time, inviting me to come play. It was healthy. It was strong. It listened, so I did too. One afternoon, I discovered an abandoned kitten curled up in our horse stalls. Our new country home came with facilities for raising horses, but my parents had no interest in maintaining a pair of healthy animals. Dirt and dry grass matted the cat's feral coat, dark orange striped in shadow. The orphan was skeletal and barely alive. His mother had left him. Slowly, I brought him back to life with shelter and food and promises. When the after-school gauntlets at home increased of empty, cheap, white wine bottles, puffy faces, and wobbly speech, I would snatch the orphan, throw him over my bony shoulder, and run outside, up the rope ladder and into the great oak's bowels. Slam with the treehouse door, and I was safe. I was free. For a moment. The cat and I would watch the animate world twist and turn below. Hairy tarantulas the size of my hairless calves navigated our tarred driveway, sticky from the day's swelter. Their legs moved with intention and mystery. I knew rattlesnakes slithered near. I could feel them splitting through grass, tongue-kissing the void for orientation. Repelled by the poison fermenting inside my home, I sided with the spiders and the snakes. Often I would lie down on musty planks wedged into the oak's open palm, and the orphan rested on my navel. I prayed. I was not religious, but often caught adults looking skyward to talk with the invisibles, to some faceless god, whenever things became heavy. And as things shattered, when the parents halved and the drinking doubled, I escaped my treehouse and hurled hand-whittled boomerang prayers to some god, to some recipient I knew absolutely nothing about. When the prayers returned, they came back dripping in moss, smelling like skunk or winking of skittle red poison oak. So when the evening dripped enough ink through wrinkled oak, I returned home. There was no escaping the discomfort that waited for me there. After that last fleeting rabbit triggered starlit poetry above, I gripped the zipline handle with one hand and my orphan in the other, and we slid off the top deck together, flying suspended in midair, eventually connecting with cracked dirt. And as I walked home, I moved slowly and methodically, like those eight-legged arachnids, like French-kissing serpents, like subtle murmurings of conifer. Falling. Burnt orange streetlights splashed Bengal stripes across the road, glazed wet from an afternoon thunderstorm. Weather had tumbled in from the west, wrestling headlocks and half Nelsons through the valley and up into the Sierra foothills. Motor oil mingled with rain and pine needles to confuse the true taste of evening's texture. Thud, 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 sniffle and thud and sniffle and thud. 17 years old and hardly a man, I had never run this hard, this fast in my life, ever. Tendons pulled and pushed while each footstrike throttled wet concrete through metatarsal and femur, eventually hardening into the crisscrossed rebar of a numbed heart. I was running away. The sloping road made it feel like I was falling, escaping something to which I never wished to return. To see my mother lying on the ground nearly lifeless on our wooden bathroom floor, that same bathroom where a tropical fish I had painted in Mrs. Bacher's third grade class hung on the wall, crooked as if leaping out of the water. That same bathroom with that same shelf housing that same cheap jade-colored bottle of cologne I would dabble behind my ears before school. Little trick I pocketed from some men's magazine. I thought she was going to die. And to be honest, a very, very small, pitiful part of me wished she would have. The overlapping pain occurred now with dulling frequency, and I no longer wanted her dependence to edge under my skin, like stinging nettle forests erupting under collarbone. It's that moment when you realize that someone you love is dying, someone you depend on, someone that gifted you life, someone you simply cannot stop loving. Though flirting with unconsciousness, I knew that she was still alive. Communication came by way of slushy words in a foreign tongue, stained by fistfuls of pain medication chased with screw-top Chardonnay. I couldn't watch this anymore, and I was much too cowardly to call 911. I needed to leave immediately, to locate another reality that didn't include such repeat destruction. So I called my aunt, started to run towards her house, several miles away. When running at night, it always seems much faster than during the day. It's called optic flow. We always perceive our movement relative to what's around us, between the observer and the observed. So that building down the road appears to be arriving much slower than that tree passing right beside you. At night, we typically only see what's immediately present. So everything appears to be moving much quicker, including ourselves. It all comes down to perspective. Optic flow tricks your mind, so progress to your destination becomes distorted. My pathetic arms pumped, hooking and jabbing the night through tear and confusion. I ran down the street, passing walls and homes and big trucks, big escape vehicles. The street was full of them, those tanks for trucks you find in almost any small town in America. One had slime-green suspension elevating it several feet off the ground. It looked detached and out of place with the aging Ponderosa looming behind it. To my left, I stopped, and I peered into a living room illuminated by Wheel of Fortune on television. A contestant had just won the purple sliver with Belize written in all caps. Flashes of getaway followed. Beaches and bodies, rainforests and daiquiris. Just go. Leave the grind behind for a while. You deserve it. A rocking chair drenched in gray-blue lumens swayed back and forth, alone and amused. Turning a corner, I stumbled over a crate overwhelmed with beer cans and wine bottles. Inside the house, a dinner party swirled with adults laughing, drinking, plum-faced. Two young boys stirred outside, throwing rocks into a nearby gulch and waiting for them to hit something solid, something real. I passed. I glanced. Disinterested in my hysterical flail, they continued to play, fishing for an echo. After reaching the highway, I sprinted along its shoulder, dangerous and delirious with foggy eyesight. A light drizzle commenced as a double semi-truck roared past, full of price tags or cheap food or chemicals or bananas or styrofoam or nothing at all, nearly knocking me down with its commanding influence. Further down the highway, red, white, and blue streamers flapped from a sign painted last week to promote a new residential development in town. Stonebrook. With its wrought iron gates and guarded fence, the neighborhood's angular repetition made me dizzy. For years, I played in these wild grasses and blackberry maze buried beneath this development, under these gates and walls and heated pools installed right during the heat of unprecedented drought. Here, there were no echoes. The rain upgraded to horizontal sheets, licking my face with a forked tongue. Off the highway now and descending a dark road, a pair of headlights started gaining on me from behind. The lights flashed violently. Someone was trying to catch my attention. I was uncertain if it was she, the one I loved so much, that nurturing one who brought me, us, into this life. Was it she, back from the dead, trying to either kill me or keep me? The thought of her driving soured my stomach. Might it be my aunt, picking me up to take me somewhere safe? Closer and brighter and closer and brighter the lights came, snaking downhill with increasing velocity and hydraulic bounce. Optic flow is no longer the issue. This machine was coming right for me, and fast. There was nowhere else to go. In the end, it often seems that escape only leads you right back to where you left. It always had for me. Between the embankment on my left and the canyon to my right, I had no place to hide. No choice but to face the oncoming lights head first. That swarm of violent fireflies erupting from an infinite dark, but gaining, gaining, always gaining. Thanks.
Thank you.
So I just gotta tell you a really embarrassing story about Lily, about me, hanging out with Lily. It's super embarrassing for me. It was last semester in Phil's class. We were workshopping one of Lily's pieces, and in the piece, and I don't want to give it away too much because I think that she's reading it. She was beautifully describing a scene where she was volunteering in the Northeast after Hurricane Irene, and the town gave her a bed and breakfast to stay in. And the bed and breakfast, she beautifully described this bed and breakfast, this bed, her bedroom, and it was just unbelievable. You know, it's all this devastation out going outside, and in this bed and breakfast, it was just incredible. And so I came into the workshop just blazing. I was like, Lily, this is great. Like, I was in the bedroom with you. Like, and I said something like that, and everyone just stopped, and was like, what? So that was my first, like, breaking of the ice with Lily. Really awkward, I'm sorry. So, on that note, you're there. You loved it. Okay, Lily is a first-year environmental studies graduate student hailing from Cincinnati, Ohio. She completed her undergraduate at the University of Chicago. Before ending up in Missoula, she worked as a park ranger, a ski valet in Maine, a tour guide in Glacier, Yellowstone, and the Tetons. Wow. An EFL teacher in Russia. She once published the Baxter State Park Junior Rangers Handbook, which is a magnum opus.
My finest work.
Finest work. And once briefly, and I really want to hear the story, she worked on an assembly line in a light bulb factory in Cincinnati.
With angry Russians.
So it's an honor to share this podium with you tonight, and let's give a warm welcome for Lily.
I'm right in the middle of a chaotic house move. And forgot that I had not connected my printer until the exact moment that I wouldn't print stuff out, so I will be reading on my phone. I'm not just texting because you're boring me. So this first piece, as Nick alluded to, is called Saving Jamaica. It was the end of summer. I had just escaped 3 months as a camp counselor, leading, sometimes dragging, campers over the white mountains of New Hampshire and the hills of Maine. The camp season had ended violently, with the onslaught of Hurricane Irene, which came howling off the Atlantic and reduced the pines of Camp Arcadia kindling. With the campers gone, the power out, and no sign that the camp administrators had any intention of feeding us anymore, the remaining staff rode the tailwind of the hurricane, scattering. I had nowhere urgent to be, so I headed west to join my boyfriend in Vermont. He was working on the Green Mountain Club trail crew and loved it. An entire summer packed into an old jeep bombing the back roads of the Northern Kingdom. The beer, he said. The axes. The backbreaking days of sweat and sawdust, followed by sublime skinny dips and secret watering holes. If only I joined the volunteer crew, he said. This too could be mine. I had to admit, it sounded tempting. We spent a few days together in Waterbury, and then I headed south to meet up with the volunteer crew in Danby. But southern Vermont was a federal disaster area. 1 week after Irene, most of the major roads are impassable. Again and again I backtracked, tracing ever sketchier detours down washed-out gravel tracks. What was normally a 2-hour, 90-mile drive ultimately took 4 hours. By the time I reached headquarters, the volunteers had long since left for work. It was raining hard, and the Danby facility was deserted, save for a single Forest Service ranger. Clouds were heavy on the hills. The ranger told me that the Green Mountain Club was temporarily out of trail work. The Green Mountain National Forest had been so heavily wind and flood damaged that the administrators had closed it to non-Forest Service crews. What were they doing instead? Disaster relief, she said. The trails are in bad shape, but the towns were worse. Only a few hours ago, the crew had relocated to the hard-hit town of Jamaica, where I followed them the next morning. Jamaica was a small town nestled misty in the mountains, all clapboard and church bells. In kinder autumns, it was a hot spot for leaf peepers. And if you've never been to Vermont and you don't know what a leaf peeper is, it's an old person, generally, forgive me, who travels specifically to New England to look at leaves in the autumn. There's entirely cottage industry based around leaf peepers and their tourist dollars.
Sounds keen.
Peachy, even. The first thing I saw was that the main bridge into town was lying in the river. I followed a line of traffic through the detour along the riverbank, bumping down a raw mud track behind gravel levees that had obviously just been piled up by excavators. Above me on the bank were houses cantilevered into the air, their front halves swept away, exposing bathroom pipes and living rooms. Several houses were marked only by the holes they had left in the bank. Of one house, only the deck remained. It was still raining. I found the volunteer crew camped at a swanky bed and breakfast in town. Not your average digs for a trail crew. The inn had been built in the 1780s. It was expensively, beautifully kept, and we were not its usual clientele. Not for the likes of us, the $75 prefix gourmet menu. The innkeeper, a surly man like an ex-boxer, said, "So you're the girl who came late, huh?" and showed me to my own room, which was gorgeous, all hardwood floors and king-size four-poster beds. And no, Nick was not there with me. After spending the summer in a dank cabin with a bunch of tween girls, this was a paradise, a veritable Elysium of lodging. Having settled in, I went downstairs to join the other volunteers. They were a mixed group. In addition to a few Carhartt-clad GMC regulars, there were two boys from China and Japan, a German-Filipino architecture student, and a pair of scruffy native Vermonters. They were sitting around the common area eating pastries and drinking coffee, while the town organizer discussed the day's projects with the crew leaders. The organizer was a remarkable-looking man. He had a straw hat, sat on waist-length, flowing gray hair that would put Gandalf to shame, and an equally long beard that cascaded over his denim overalls. To complete this outfit, he wore green Wellington boots. He was consulting a list of townspeople who had requested help. Although we could do little on a structural level, there were tons of brush, mud, and rubble to be cleared away, particularly in the crooks and crannies where power equipment would never reach. The organizer knew everyone in town and prioritized their needs accordingly. Shortly thereafter, we broke into groups to start the day's assignments. Instead of axes, we were armed with gloves, hard hats, and shovels. There's a kind of excitement in the humid air, a geared-up feeling. Looking at Jamaica, it was impossible not to want to wade in and start putting things back together. My group was assigned to help an older couple clean out their basement. They had a formerly nice, now muddy yard, accessed by a pretty little bridge that ran over a creek to their house. From the creek rose the smell of sewage and rotting apples. "I drained 2 feet of water out of this basement day after the storm," the old man said. "Uses a little sump pump, but you see how it's still wet in the low areas. I've got a dirt floor with a layer of plastic, then gravel over top. If we could just bring up the plastic and get all the mud out from under there. Got a crawl space full of mud, too. Maybe one of you two's younger people and smaller people." He looked significantly at me and the next shortest person, Kevin. Kevin took off his dapper hat, which he was wearing in lieu of the regulated hard hats, and looked far happier than he had any reason to be. "Crawl space? Where? I'll volunteer for that." While the others started digging drainage channels, Army Corps of Engineers style, Kevin and I ventured into the crawl space, a little limbo room above the basement, but under the first floor. Huge clumps of gooey, stinking gray mud had settled in there. We crouched down in the glow of an electrician's lamp and hacked away at it with short-handled shovels. "That's great." The old man's face appeared at the opening. "Here, take this sled and fill it up." He pushed in a child's toboggan, and we filled it with mud so it could be hauled away. Somewhere deep down, I had always wondered what it felt like to be an 18th-century child coal miner. And now I knew. In spite of this, I was enjoying my first day of volunteering. It felt good to be working. We tossed talk back and forth easily, like catch, to the rhythm of shoveling. When the day was done, we all went to the garage at the inn, which doubled as a freezer, and changed into clean clothes, then took turns hosing off our muddy work clothes before putting them in the wash. The innkeeper met us at the front door. "The volunteer fire department in Manchester sent over some hot dogs for your dinner," he said. "They're probably still warm." They weren't, but everything else was so luxurious that it didn't matter at all. Over the next few days in Jamaica, we hauled debris to the dump, shoveled cellars, lugged mud-clogged junk out of ruined basements, and similar tasks, before tromping back every night to lounge in incongruous luxury. Kevin went down in town history when he unearthed a can of beer that had been buried in the flood of 1973 and drank it. He did, too. In the background, the seething small-town politics of Jamaica. Peter Smith didn't want a dumpster parked on his property. Some people thought the excavators in the river were violating EPA regulations and ought to be stopped. Mr. Jones wanted to know why nobody had come to help him yet. It was complicated when FEMA and the National Guard showed up. The guards parked their Humvees at the inn and tromped in and out all day in combat boots. The FEMA people arrived in a Chevy with New York plates, brandishing paperwork. They toured the town and studied washed-out Water Street with deep skepticism. "How do we know there was ever actually a house here?" one agent said. "Where's the proof?" By now, of course, the proof was probably 5 miles downstream in a pile of matchsticks. At last, there were no more volunteer-sized tasks to be done, and a dozen other towns crying for help. We packed to go. "Come back for a visit," said the town organizer, still in his hat and overalls, "in about 25 years, when we rebuilt." He laughed, but I knew he wasn't kidding. We pulled out on Thursday, leaving Jamaica to the bulldozers and the government. That's the end of that piece. I switched this piece out at the last minute in honor of the blizzard. It's a piece set in Moscow, where I was nicknamed. I worked in 2009 and 2010 as an EFL teacher. It was the coldest winter in Moscow in 60 years. And instead of putting ice melt down on the sidewalks, they had Central Asian migrant laborers who rode around with these big sacks of sawdust and sprinkled sawdust on the sidewalks. And they just hack at the packed up ice with pickaxes to try and clear it off. So it was quite a very snowy and dramatic scene. And that's the context for this piece, which is called Walking in Snow. There was a spell of harsh weather, and I barely went out. But one afternoon, getting that old cabin fever feeling again, I bundled up and ventured into the blizzard. There were so few hours of daylight there, you had to steal what chances you could. I walked through my neighborhood, crossed the main road. The snow was falling hard and the drifts made walls along the sidewalks. But at Oktoberskaya, people had tramped out a footpath leading downhill, away from the street, towards the park and the forest. So I followed this path. I wasn't alone, of course. Ahead of me, an elderly man was walking with his wife, one in a big hat, the other in a long fur coat, tromping along hand in hand in a blizzard on a Friday afternoon in January. And other people, men mostly, but a few women, alone, pacing very slowly with their heads bowed and their hands behind their backs. They didn't seem to be going anywhere in particular, just walking. I guess I, too, was one of the just walkers. So we went on this way, over a bridge and over a frozen spillway to the shores of a broad basin all filled up with snow. Skulnoye Ozera, School Lake. There's a boathouse at the near end. I could just see the top of a beached pontoon boat sticking out of the snow, and close by the lifeguard towers and changing huts of a swimming beach. There's something lovely and surreal about a beach in the snow. I don't know why. Out on the ice, a man had a little fire going in a can. He was crouched over a hole ice fishing, and nearby another group was doing the same. Where they had cleaned their fish, there was bloodstains in the snow. Then I had to step off the path to let a cross-country skier go by. But 5 minutes later, I was ahead of him again. He wasn't a very good skier, and he'd tripped out of his skis. Further down the lake, there were other skiers, and some children tobogganing down the bank onto the ice. I passed a group having a picnic on a park bench. The two men were standing. The girl was on the bench, but crouched on the balls of her feet, not actually sitting because of the Russian dread of cold surfaces. And in context for that, Russians believe that if you walk barefoot on the cold ground, you will go sterile, or possibly die, or both. I was on a balcony barefoot one time, and a woman who worked in a maternity clinic told me this. I was like, perhaps you should not be working in a maternity clinic. But I digress. Anyway, because of the Russian dread of cold surfaces, they were like hunkered on this bench on the balls of their feet. They had laid out a whole spread on the bench, sausages, vodka, a jar of pickles, and they didn't look up as I passed. When I got to the very end of the lake, I stopped and looked back. Everything was hazy and monochrome in the falling snow. The low sky, the forest, the beach, and the small dark figures moving through the landscape made it seem like a Bruegel painting. Somewhere someone let off a firework. A flock of gray crows lifted from a pine, and a woman who had been pacing on her way paused just for a minute and looked around. When it was silent again, I realized I could hear the snow falling on my hat and shoulders. And that was the end of that.
These blues gonna take a long, long time.